And welcome back to the Middle Chamber. Thanks for joining us for part two of our talk with Jon Ervin and Joe Atwill, discussing their new video, Psychedelic Intelligence, as well as mind control and the CIA's involvement in the counterculture movement. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy.
Yeah, for many years, I would ask every so-called baby boomer that I would come into contact, so were you in the movement? You know, because I was sort of infatuated with this idea. And they'd say, most, I would say probably 3 out of 4 or 5 of the people that I would ask these questions, especially males, would tell me that the whole movement to them was a fashion to get laid. That's what it was all about. And they'd said guys with short hair who didn't talk about revolution didn't get laid.
If you took the sex out of it, there would have been absolutely zero participation in it. It was how it was sold. I mean, look at Easy Rider, and how which is one of the precursor of the youth culture in the mass media, and just look how sex is used in the film to try to draw people in. The whole idea of living communally is absurd. I mean, you want to go out and sit there with the squirrels watching the wheat grow. No one wished to do that. They were hoping to go out and just have sex with lots of different people. That's what it was about. The people who design these things, they know what they're doing. They certainly understand human nature. They've been studying it for centuries.
Well, let me just interject, Joe. Guess who created the idea of the commune? That was all based off of Aldous Huxley's book, The Island.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the utopian idea goes way back, but it's obviously Huxley had done he was part of the group that was doing the research, and they were designing the culture that they thought would be the easiest from which to enslave people. I wanted to just branch off for 1 second and to go back to the concept of trust, because the basic element of trust requires these lifetime actors. And I just wanted to have that concept put forward so that your listeners would have it in their mind, because I think it's very valuable. When you have people like Wasson and Huxley and Bernays, I mean, what you have are actors. In other words, they never give the public the truth about what they're doing. They have to maintain character forever. And so this shows just how pervasive in their life the dedication to the organization is, because they can never leave character, right? They have to stay in character forever. So when you hear, for example, Terrence McKenna's audio that Jon uncovered, in which he talks about working in deep background after having been recruited, doing public relations for the drugs, you can see that he has been essentially brought into this idea of a lifetime actor. And the way you can really always identify them is when they directly contradict what they are doing with their words. So when Huxley is on Mike Wallace in the famous interview where he is saying how worried he is about the government having knowledge of how drugs can control population, right? He's saying he's so worried about this. It's just a terrible thing. Okay, he says this, but then in Moshe, a book that he produced, you have descriptions of him conducting experiments in this, right? So in other words, he's developing the technology that he's supposedly afraid of. If you look at, not Wasson, but... Jesus, I'm sorry. The anthropologist
Bateson,
you'll see that he is at Esalen, and there he is presenting himself as a humanist, right? He's promoting Buddhism, the new kind of loving mankind sort of ideas that are purportedly coming out of Esalen. But then, if you look at his actual words in the Freedom of Information Act, which is in David Price's book, Weaponizing Anthropology, and Jon and I will be quoting from in the upcoming article, what you'll see is that his words contradict his statements about himself. The words themselves point out that he is actually developing technology to enslave people. He's not... trying to create, the freedom of mankind. He's not freeing anybody. He's developing the techniques of slavery. So this is really, it goes to how to be a skeptical and a rational citizen. You have to have that concept. You have to question as to whether or not an individual has been given a platform in the media that is false, that the persona that he's giving to you is completely fake.
There are ways to determine that.
Yeah.
Let me give you another example of exactly what Joe is talking about here, and that's in President Eisenhower's famous speech when he's leaving the presidency and he warns of the military-industrial complex.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and so what we have here is Eisenhower, behind the scenes, we know for a fact, we have the documents, was actually working with Huxley and Gordon Wasson at the Century Club, and then he's involved in all of this stuff. Eisenhower was involved with the Council on Foreign Relations and all of these things, who were creating this very military-industrial complex that he was warning about. So what it does is it creates what is called plausible deniability. If you're out, if you're out there talking about this stuff going on, and you're saying, warning people about it, like, you know, Huxley and his pal Eisenhower are doing, then you're not gonna, you know, you're not gonna question them. You know, if the lion is pointing at the flock of, you know, if a lion is pointing at, you know, another sheep or whatever, and saying it's the lion or it's that guy over there, you're not going to expect that it was the lion. And bad analogy, whatever. But that's basically what it gets down to.
Well, listen, you mentioned Moksha, Joe, or Moksha, and we have a copy of that book as well. And I'll admit that I've only read the excerpts that you've quoted, Jan, from that
book.
And let me just say real quick.
I've actually got a quote of Huxley trying to say it's spiritual in one place, right when he first takes it. And then in another place, you know, saying that, you know, that the government is going to use narco-hypnosis to control everyone. It'll be better than clubs and prisons. So which is it? Is it spiritual or is it better than clubs and prisons? You can't have it both ways at the same time, you know?
Right. And what I was going to say was, if you take the citations that you and Joe have isolated from that material and take that and then apply it to another volume called Brave New World Revisited,
right,
that little second sequel to Brave New World that he wrote, all of a sudden, it's horrifying. He's matter-of-factly describing what, you know, he was involved in. I mean, you can't know these things, it seems, unless you're right there with firsthand knowledge, right?
Right. Well, and that's the interesting thing is that, you know, and this, the MK Ultra research was top secret. Okay. And so here we have Huxley. He's working with Humphrey Osmond. He's working with Abram Hoffer. He's working with this doctor in Egypt. He is on top of all of the research that Dr. Andrea Puharich is doing at Edgewood Arsenal. And he's also having sleepovers with Dr. Louis Jolyon West, the guy, the infamous doctor who injected like 30,000 or 300,000 milligrams of LSD into Tusco the elephant. And the elephant, this was pretty much the largest elephant in the world. And the thing keeled over dead on the spot. And, you know, and this guy, Dr. Louis Jolyon West, he was famous for all of these MKUltra studies that he was doing. And he's the one that came up with the famous quote about, you know, using the drugs to control the population through either prohibition or supply. And so this is, you know, this guy's hanging out, you know, stays at Huxley's house and all of this stuff. But you can see that, you know, Huxley couldn't have had knowledge. And not only that, he's going to the American Psychiatric Association in there. In other books, we can see him talking about how he's had just read this or that Journal of Psychology or Psychiatry. So, I mean, he is literally up and on top of all of this research, this mind research going on. And then there's a letter where Julian Huxley comes to L.A., and that's Huxley's brother, and they go around to, like, UCLA and various universities to look at the animal studies going on animal mind control. And this was, like, in the 50s. This is, like, you know, 15 to 20 years before MKUltra was even known of Aldous Huxley knew the names of the people, was hanging out with them, was recommending studies, and was at the meetings. We also know that he was at the Macy Foundation conferences on control of the mind that were funded by the MKUltra program.
Dr. West, didn't he also interview Sirhan Sirhan and Timothy McVeigh?
He was the doctor for Sirhan Sirhan, I think possibly Lee Harvey Oswald, Jack Ruby, I know for sure, and Patty Hearst. Now, interestingly, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald, boy, there are so many connections into MKUltra with that guy. And it's pretty clear that he was a fall guy for the whole situation. But his handler was a guy by the name of George de Morenshield. And we have actual documents and letters that prove that George de Morenshield worked with, drumroll, Gordon Wasson. And he ran at least two funds with Wasson for the Soviet Union. Now, Wasson's wife was Russian. George de Morenshield and his brother Dmitry von Morenshield were both Russian. Now, Dmitry worked at Harvard in the Russian Studies program and also knew Wasson. But here we have Lee Harvey Oswald right in the mix of this whole situation. In fact, I've asked Oswald's mistress, Judy Very Baker, if she knew or it had met Gordon Wasson hanging out with with Lee Harvey Oswald, but she refused. After like 7 or 8 attempts, she refused each time to give me a straight answer.
Okay, so Jan and Joe, how has your research been received in general?
Well, well in some areas and by some groups and poorly in others. I mean, it depends on, since our research has kind of a breadth to it, you have to be specific. The my research in Christianity has been extremely well received by the readers of the book, certainly. I mean, it's perhaps the best-selling book of New Testament scholarship in the last 10 years. It's been very well received. And since there is no promotional budget, all of the sales come through word of mouth by people essentially thinking that the research is, has meaning. My new book is Shakespeare's Secret Messiah is even more controversial. So it's hard to know how that will come about. I've received hundreds of responses about the article Jan and I wrote, and all of them have been positive. No one that has come to it through having read Caesar's Messiah and then reading the article has any negative comments. And I think that's probably because you aren't contradicting sort of the basic premise of the research. When Jan started, he was really more an advocate, I think, or at least was objective toward psychedelics. And so it was really quite an act of cognition for him to step into a position where he was exposing a different origin for the drug entering the culture. And so when the article came out, I think Jan got quite a bit of flack from people who felt betrayed.
Oh, I got thousands of messages. You know, there were and still are every day just about positive ones, but I got a lot of hate mail and attackers. And most interestingly, though, it was the attackers were centered around certain people that I have long suspected of being a part of this thing, like Daniel Pinchbeck's friends. And of course, Daniel Pinchbeck and his film on 2012, he hangs out with Sting or Gordon Sumner from the Police, who Stuart Copeland, the drummer for the Police, Stuart Copeland's dad created the CIA and OSS, you know. And Daniel Pinchbeck hung out with Allen Ginsberg, who we know was involved in MKUltra and CIA, and he was also hanging out with Jack Kerouac and William Burroughs, etc. And so he was right there in the Greenwich Village scene. So, and then from him. You know, there's Simon Powell launched his attacks, and then Joe Rogan, who I was a friend with for like a decade, he suddenly, you know, I even offered to go to Joe's house with the documents and show him everything, and he refused. And then 3 days later, he went public attacking me. And then lately, Graham Hancock has been going all over the place attacking my work. But none of them have ever addressed a single thing that Joe and I actually wrote. They will distort every single item that stated, which they did in the earlier article on Gordon Wasson that I published in 2012. But they always create these massive straw man arguments and then come at me with all of this name calling, you're crazy, you're this or that. But they will never address the actual research. And of course, that's intentional. I think, you know, they were furious because here was somebody who was in the heart of the psychedelic community, and I was a researcher, I've written books on it, and then all of a sudden, you know, well, not all of a sudden, I was researching Gordon Wasson's background from 2006, 2007, and so it was building up, and then all of a sudden, we had all of this information that Wasson was CIA and all of this stuff. But then what happened was, you know, the hero of the psychedelic movement, Gordon Wasson, was suddenly exposed. And then that forces everyone to begin questioning the foundations of the whole field. And so, you know, there was a concerted effort from the White House to the Department of Defense, to the CIA, to you name it. I mean, you know, they put people on me to mislead my research and attack me.
So, Jan, you were an advocate of entheogens.
I was now? Well, you know, here's the thing, and I'm still basically an ethnobotanist or an ethnomycologist. I just focus my research in a different direction. But early on, I thought, you know, that psychedelics could be, you know, a spiritual component. I've tried them many times for all those haters out there who say, you've never tried them. I've tried them more than a few hundred times. And, you know, so I was researching, writing all of this stuff. And then, you know, John Allegro was kind of the one guy who was always saying, you know, this was dumbing the people down. It was sort of a system of control. And I, you know, early on, I didn't believe him and I thought they were more spiritual, you know, but I started working with his daughter and verifying all of this research. And so we could see that there was, you know, he was exposing these substances in Judeo-Christianity. And then all of a sudden, there was this huge come down from the CIA and from guys like Gordon Wasson. And Gordon Wasson, by the way, he was the vice president for J.P. Morgan Bank, and he was in charge of propaganda for J.P. Morgan Bank. So it was Gordon Wasson who launched all of these attacks. And then, you know, that made me start questioning Wasson and the whole, you know, background scene with Allegro, which then led me to questioning, you know, are these things really spiritual or am I looking at it from the wrong perspective? You know, what the predator thinks of these substances is totally different and irrelevant. You know, if they're spiritual or not is irrelevant to the predator. The predator is using them one way. Now, you know, what's interesting is when we look in the Bible, even, you know, right in the beginning of the Bible, they're warning us, you know, the story of the fruit of the tree of knowledge and all of this stuff. And what's interesting is when we look in that May 13, 1957 Life magazine article, Wasson is in there talking about his walk in the woods with Valentina, and that is actually a direct takeoff from Genesis 3.
So do you think, or not think, rather, that there is a valid application of entheogens,
well, you know,
as a practice or as a spiritual enlightenment?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. As a practice defined as what, you know, and the more I'm seeing how MAPS functions, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, and sort of giving these government-sanctioned clinics in. Well, if you go back way back to the Eleusinian Mysteries in ancient Greece that went on for 2,000 years, it was a government-sanctioned religion. So if we have all of these clinics around the country dispensing the religious quote-unquote experience with psychedelics, and mind you, they had to rename them from psychotomimetic, which means psychosis mimicking, or from a psychotic break to a psychedelic or manifesting the mind, to an entheogen, to manifesting God. When we see this whole line of sales, and when we go back and we look at how two Greek families, the Eumolpids and the Chirknes, controlled the entire Eleusinian Mysteries, these two families, for 2,000 years and had total sanction by the government, then we have to look at MAPS and all of this stuff in a different light. And, you know, I mean, I got to where I am today by using them and studying them for 20 years and studying ethnomycology. But, you know, I didn't have a dog in the fight. So when the evidence changed the other direction, I just went with, you know, where the evidence went. And, you know, so, you know, to me, it's more important to get the information out. Do these substances have value in that sense? I can't just, you know, make a broad sweeping generalization and say, no, they have no medical value. I mean, certainly ibogaine and ayahuasca have use in treating alcoholism and heroin addiction and things like that. They've also been helpful in treating some people with schizophrenia, but they've also created as much schizophrenia, you know, so it is a double-edged sword. You know, if somebody's seriously addicted to heroin or alcohol, they should probably try to find an ibogaine clinic. It might save their lives. But all of these things, you know, have to be looked at in context. And the issue becomes, you know, this thing, and I used to, when I first heard this, I think I heard it from Leonard Peikoff, and he said in a talk, The History of Philosophy, that mysticism was the tool of tyrants. And when I heard that, I just thought that comment was the most ridiculous thing I had ever heard, and that he was completely full of you-know-what. And I was on a long drive for like 6 or 8 hours, and I had a whole long time to think about that comment. And so for, you know, sometime after that, and then days and weeks going on, I would try to find instances where mysticism wasn't the tool of tyrants. And, you know, the more I look into it, the more I realize, you know, it's something that falls on what is called the onus of proof and arguing the arbitrary. If somebody makes a claim, they should be able to prove it. If they can't, it's called arguing the arbitrary, and it's thrown out by default as a false argument. And so when you realize...
Where does intuition fall into that?
Well, intuition is actually the first stage of all of that. And when you get into studying the trivium, for instance, the intuition is what tells you something's not right here. And then that kicks in the left side of the mind, which goes in and looks at all of the logical fallacies and everything and says, aha, this person just tried to use that against me. But what they did was essentially they got everybody to truncate the rest of it and stop at intuition. And so then it sort of sucks everybody into that. I mean, it feels great. It feels like a religious experience. But the goal is they sell you the emotional idea and that thinking and thought and your five senses are bad and invalid and you can't trust anything. And this is how they use it as a system of control, because when you don't understand the onus of proof, they've got you.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right. And I would just say it isn't necessarily a negative thing where you're saying no drugs. It's really trying to go to the positive. You need to develop reason and trust in your senses. And these are acts of sobriety. So this is the bedrock. You need to develop those things. And then, of course, intuition and imagination are components, but everything must always end up filtered through the bedrock. You just need to train yourself to be able to use logic, to use reason, and to understand the fallacies, which Jan is continuing to point out. And if you are able to do that, then you are not as likely to succumb to this kind of activity by the governments or whoever is the oligarchs that are trying to, you know, diddle with your mind.
Hence the need for all the propaganda.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. What I put in the article with Joe is, you know, way at the very end at the conclusion is that you should probably at least have a 2-year study of the trivium before you go and dabble in these things, because there is such a huge risk for mind control and being misled that at least if you have that foundation, you're far less likely to be fooled if you do go dabble with them.
Right. And I wrote that I was opposed to them under any circumstances. And that was mainly because the culture is a drug in and of itself. You know, we are constantly being given concepts that are designed to fool us and to confuse us and to keep us from our senses and our reason. And since that is the case, since there is such a chronic attack upon our consciousness, it's just not a condition, not a situation that you want them to be able to create drugs that are designed to take you away from your senses and from your capacity to reason. So, you know, I don't use the drugs. I advocate, you know, that people stay away from them and try to instead develop a fascination with logic and connection to their senses. And I think that that'll give you a better defense against the culture as it exists today.
Well, I got to agree with you on that last point you made, but I personally myself, I consider myself a seeker, and I don't know, maybe that's been conditioned into me or whatever, but I also kind of think that there's certain aspects of our psyche that, you know, aren't necessarily right in front of us that we can get to right away. And I do believe that in some way or another, entheogens or psychedelics or whatever you want to call them can help access those parts within us that maybe will help us to get a better idea of ourselves.
And then, but going back, Mater X, going back to my point earlier, we have to realize, you know, Gordon Wasson with the magic mushrooms, you know, Maria Sabina was very clear that they were used for healing rituals or, you know, healing ceremonies, I should say, and for finding lost objects. Sold us. Like, if you go into Albert Hoffman's first experience with LSD, quote unquote, I mean, he doesn't talk anything about it being religious. And so these were actually things that were marketed to us later down the line. They actually created this native revivalism or the archaic revival, the neo-shamanism, and then they slammed us together with these older cultures, essentially trying to destroy both at the same time.
Yeah, I would point out I have taken psychedelic drugs. I mean, I'm too old for anything at this point other than, you know, Metamucil. But the fact is that what scares me is that when people look for aspects, you know, uncovered aspects of their consciousness. The problem is simply that so many of the concepts that you bring to the experience have already been given to you by culture, and they were essentially, they're just part of the drug. So you're not always sure what you're seeing is real. I think the understanding of what is real is the most important goal of all of us, of all humans, to know what is real as best we can. And so I would just argue that there is a real value in sobriety, connection to the senses, understanding logic that we have not been given. And we don't have the kind of natural curiosity and fascination that we should have with these things. This is the real path of our lives. And this is why it's been stopped. This is why they've taken it from us. You see, all of these ideas about our mind even, these aren't ideas that have been produced by people who are on a righteous path. These are coming from the enslavers.
The Bible.
What a great point.
The
Joe.
Bible.
That is such a great point.
The Bible calls this the fall, you guys.
Yeah.
But let me just say real quick that you know, I had done psychedelics about 200 times, and I'll tell you, the first night that I had a quote-unquote full-blown spiritual or religious-type experience with psychedelics was none other than the very night that I had met Tim Leary and Dennis McKenna.
Oh, wow.
Did they put that in you, Jan?
I think so, because I had never had a spiritual quote-unquote trip in all of those 200 times before that night.
Those sorcerers.
Well, I comment real quick on the concept that, you know, like you were saying how Maria Sabina had said that these were for healing purposes. And I am that kind of goes along with what I was saying about myself being a seeker and trying to access certain parts of myself so that I could heal myself.
Well, they were talking about physical sickness, not like spiritual, westernized, new age sort of a healing thing. They were talking about actual physical sickness. Like, you know, they're living in the mountains in Oaxaca, Mexico, you know, 1,000 miles from nowhere, that type of sickness.
Okay, I understand. And that makes sense, you know. And I mean, it kind of goes along with what I've heard about ayahuasca as far as like how, you know, the shamans would be speaking to the plants or the animals while they were on the ayahuasca.
Right. Well, be careful with a lot of that stuff too, because if when you get into Michael Harner's work and these guys were intel, and they literally and Michael Harner worked with Wasson, by the way, and Carlos Castaneda, who also worked with Wasson. But they sold those ideas. Like if you go in and, you know, episode number 6 on my show was with a guy. He was a very famous Professor Neil Whitehead. And he was one of the only professors in the entire world who dared to ever write about dark shamanism. And he did a couple of books on the Kanema in Guyana in South America. And he was actually the victim of a dark shaman attack. Nearly all of the shaman ideas that have been sold in the U.S. are watered down, whitewashed versions of shamanism that omit literally half of the entire practice. So, and then what we did is we sold it back to the shamans and the people down there. We took it, we twisted it, and then we sold it back to them. But if you get in, you know, go and listen to episode number 6 of the Gnostic Media Podcast, because this guy, Professor Neil Whitehead, he died 2 years ago of pneumonia. But he had exposed this whole thing. And, you know, even some of these cultures that used ayahuasca, they use them for very dark purposes.
Well, that brings me back to the concept of trust that Joe was talking about earlier. And when he was talking about that, it made me think about the sexual abuses perpetrated by the clergy in not just the Catholic religion, but also Judaism and what was there, another one? I think.
What
Islam,
about all of the?
Any of them.
What about all of the sexual abuse and the rapes that go on with the tourists that go down to Peru, et cetera? Exactly the same line.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But I was gonna wonder about like the whole concept of trust. You know, it's kind of used against us in a way because we're putting our trust into these people. And they're doing some horrible things, and I just wonder, you know, like why do you think children in general are targeted this way, and what do you think the I don't know the agenda is in that, or is there one?
Condition the kids trust. Joe, yeah, take it.
Well, this is the point where the mind control is the easiest to develop. I mean, why would they create a show as stupid as Hannah Montana if they didn't have Miley Cyrus's twerp dancing in mind? The trust is created in the first with the children, and then the blow is delivered once the trust is developed.
Exploited later, yeah. Yeah, you know, sure. A point that was made earlier, Jan made the point about talking about the substances that are used, and you mentioned intuition divorced from reason, and you know that the idea is, yeah, intuition is readily employed and useful if it's coupled with reason, you know, and one must admit, looking at Aldous Huxley's Island book, for example, that right in there it depicts moksha use and the experience as a sort of antidote to mundanity. That it's literally being offered in the story. They give the moksha experience as a way to kind of, you know, deal with the everyday life, you know, just the simple boringness or whatever. I mean, at least that's what I got out of it. So you can see he's even suggesting it in the storyline, you know, right there in Island.
You know, and I have to say, in relation to this whole Huxley thing that we've all been talking about and that you've been talking about, Jan, when you first brought this up, or when I first heard you bring this up, I found myself very defensive about Huxley's involvement in all of this. I loved Brave New World as a story. I loved Island as a story, even though they did kind of have a pessimistic tone to them and one of the, you know, we're doomed to fail anyways kind of a thing. But I still found myself defending the idealism that I saw in those stories. But I got to tell you, though, you know, in going over your research, you've kind of convinced me that I might have been a little flawed in my thinking there.
Well, you know, if you know, people who
you weren't flawed in your thinking. Is that you just the victim of very well-designed propaganda?
Yeah, well, it's right. Called cognitive dissonance, and the clinical term for what you're experiencing is called the Stockholm syndrome. And so, it's easier for most people to lash out and attack me or Joe than it is to read the research, go through the citations, and verify them themselves. And not only that, they're sold all of this quantum physics nonsense to not even trust their five senses to go out and verify the citations. You know, and then they'll say, oh, well, there is no truth. You know, that's just your perspective, really. You know, let's look at the citations. Let's not think with fallacies, and let's
wait a
second. Verify.
Here's a line for a song. Nothing is real.
Nothing to get hung about.
Well, you know, Mark Twain said it best. He said, I believe, something along the lines of, it's easier to fool a person than to convince them they're being fooled.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. You know, and this is why the trivium is so important and why studying it before using psychedelics is so important, because it gives you a systematic method of verifying any information that comes in via the five senses. You can see all of the parts of speech and, you know, all of these, you know, items around you. They're basically nouns and, you know, all of their attributes. And so it gives you a way to process and order the information and then go through and re-verify it anytime any new information comes in. Was the old information fallacious? Was my conclusion then fallacious? Or is this new information coming in fallacious or contradictory, etc.? So it gives us a way to verify things and to spot if someone is trying to trick us. And so...
You know, I don't mean to interrupt, but I just wanted to mention that the drug and pseudo-religions like Christianity have been given to us to lead us astray. But the real religion, the real spiritual quest is, in fact, found in our senses and in logic.
And in truth,
The fascination that has been developed with these artificial worlds is actually a false energy, because if someone begins to develop their lives around those principles of their senses and reason, they're going to find a spiritual path that is an infinity more fulfilling than the ones that are basically hallucinations and are being done just to keep you in mind control. This is really what, you know, this is kind of why I take such a hard line against drugs, is because it's not that they're bad or there can't be useful things with them. It's just that we have been kept from our real religion, from our real spirituality, which is founded, even though these elements seem dull to us now, formal logic. How many people really like to study this? How many people really like to go through
this? And you know, it's really fun when you do too. And you can sit there and you can sit around with your friends watching commercials and things like that and calling out all. I mean, it's a blast.
This is the religion that has to be developed in order to create a world that it's worthwhile to live in.
But you know,
so what should we call this new religion?
Well, we don't call it any religion,
I'm just kidding.
You know. But you know,
well,
here's
guys,
the thing:
they're
is
they're going to suspect you of being social engineers. You guys are trying to start a new religion.
That's what I just said. No religion, but
right way.
You know, the religion should be learning to trust yourself and how to find truth and facts, and learning that there are truth and facts out there, and it's not just some quantum delusion sold to you by Einstein and Amit Goswami and these guys. But you know, this whole issue, people really need to consider why it is so important for these groups, Aldous Huxley and his Brave New World and his drug Soma and his drug Moksha and all of this stuff, and going back to the Brahma class and going way, way, way back about 6,000 years to the Mahabharata. Why was it so important for the Brahma class, the ruling elite class, 6,000 years ago to create these religious systems that they then fed to the lower classes? Why was that? And then why are we so ready to go, you know, adopt all of these religious principles? And when we realize that we can trust ourselves and we realize that truth does exist, then we also realize, well, wait, you know, this Brahma system, this Hindu caste system, and these Eastern religions were designed to keep people in this state of mind of, you know, you're going to be reborn and you're just in this place now. You're in dog life now because that's where you need to be. And later on in another life, you'll be born as a Brahmin and then you can have the Brahmin life. So right now, you just need to be a good slave. And so they would package, you know, spirituality and meditation and things like that with them. And in fact, We're preparing to do a show with this guy, Bill, up in Canada, and he is a former yoga and meditation instructor of like 12 years or longer, and he also got a hold of the Trivium and started putting all of this stuff together, and so he's got a whole presentation that he's almost done putting together now, and we've been talking on and off the last few weeks. But that shows that the whole meditation system that was created in the Eastern religious system was also created originally to cause a psychotic break. And so, you know, I'm really looking forward, you know, and I don't have all of the details and I don't want to ruin it for everybody yet. But, you know, that's one of the shows that people can look forward to coming soon on Gnostic Media is how they did this. So, again, you know, Huxley and these sons of bitches are, you know, up at the, you know, CIA's Esalen Institute up in Northern California. They're constantly promoting these Eastern religious ideas and philosophies and saying all logic, all thinking, all Western philosophy is bad. Now, why is that? Why don't they want you to think? Why are they selling all that?
I wonder, sometimes I wonder, you know, like our, all of the socially divisive issues that we have today, race, gender, sexual orientation, even drugs or no drugs or anything like that, or God or no God.
These are the slave issues.
Right.
Well said,
Joe. That are distractions.
Yeah,
right?
They're slave issues.
They're the distractions to keep us from realizing our own godness.
Exactly.
Well, and also to realize that we're slaves, you know, so which of course is the same thing. And I just want to make one real quick comment to Materex is that I don't want to beat this horse too much, but you know, if you actually just sort of commit to developing a spirituality through your senses and reason, through yourself, you know, I think you're going to find that what you will uncover will be not only far more interesting than anything that can ever be discovered through drugs, but that the energy that your progress gives you is sustaining. It doesn't go away. You will become more and more powerful in yourself every single day with this approach to spirituality, the approach through your senses and reason. And so that's the payoff, is that it actually, it is not just a drug, but it is the correct drug. It's finally the drug that we really have been kept from us.
It helps you build a future for yourself and your family and all of that. You know, instead of pillow sitting and being high, you know, like I did who knows how many hundreds of nights, what if I had taken all of that energy from all of those nights of being high and put it to you know, myself and my family's future instead? Where would I be today? I mean, it's impossible to even know or to calculate, you know, and obviously I was able to come through all of that and then take all of that information and team up with guys like Joe to help other people wake up from it. But, you know, if I hadn't done that, if I had gotten the Trivium like my son at age 6 or 7, where would I be today?
Right. Yeah. And I totally concur with you, Joe. I really think that you're onto something there. I'm not trying to say that I think that I should be, you know, using drugs to find my spiritual path or whatever. I used to call myself an agnostic as a kid because I just never really got religion at all. I didn't understand the point to organize religion, especially the Christianized version of it, where, you know, you're born in sin and then you need to be redeemed and salvation and all that stuff. And I know some people who are members of a group of like very fundamentally Christian peoples who live very communally, and I personally am very drawn to a communal lifestyle, but maybe that's just because I came from a big family. I like people around, and I think that it's easier to do things, to get things accomplished when you're part of a group.
But family is not really like the commune or communistic ideology. Family is a backbone of society that's absolutely required and necessary, and especially extended family, the aunts, uncles, cousins, you know, that type of situation, rather than the nuclear family here in the U.S., literally is something that supports the whole unit, whereas communism takes it to a central, you know, authority head, you know, and community, and then designates them the power figure rather than this cohesive unit of the family tribe. So, you know, they're quite the antithesis, whereas communism and socialism are specifically designed to break that and then get the single moms taking the checks from the government so that they'll never retaliate against the state.
Right.
Hello?
I'm sorry. Yeah, I hit the mute button. I'm sorry. I've just always kind of been under the idea that there's so many, there's as many paths up the mountain to personal enlightenment that, as there are people in this world, I think, you know. And the one of the hardest things for me, I spent some time with these people that I was talking about, you know, and I really got so attracted to their lifestyle. And I was even willing to go so far as to say, okay, well, just because I'm a woman, I'll stay home with the kids, even though that's not exactly what I'd like to do, but just to live in a more family oriented environment, you know.
Well,
but
and when you get in and you study Karen Strouin's work of Girl Rights What and everything, she exposes how feminism and all of that stuff was designed to intentionally break the backbone of the family, fill people's heads with selfish needs instead of, you know, the family group needs, because then without that family unit, without dads acting as dads and with dads all feminized and without moms acting as moms and with moms all masculinized or women, you know, then they can really get in and break that family unit apart and then get people reliant upon the state. And if you're reliant upon the state, literally the state has total control over you.
Absolutely. Right. And so I couldn't stay with these people because, I mean, for one thing, I didn't feel like I needed salvation, that any God out there wasn't going to give me salvation, that I could only provide that for myself, really, by going within and getting to know myself and finding out what worked for me. But if I could have just, if they could have accepted that about myself, about me, then I could have probably lived with them. But even with the whole like patriarchy and woman's place in the home kind of a thing, which I honestly do rail against in a lot of ways, but I do see the inherent value of the mother.
Right. Well, again, you gotta check out Karen Strouin's work of Girl Rights What, because she exposes all of that as a fraud, and literally that was sold to us. And when you get the inverse of how things actually were, when you see the underside of how they manipulated all of the information, you're going to be pretty shocked.
I don't know if I'll be that shocked, because I'm pretty open to that kind of a thing.
It's one of the most disturbing area. I studied Karen's work for like 2 weeks, and it put me out. I mean, it was really depressing stuff, you know.
Right. Yeah, sure.
I'll even go further. I think that they attack us chemically, and you get gender bending hormones in clothes and in food. And this is not a circumstance. They really want to, depopulate certain groups and to break down a family as a structure, because, of course, when you are cast adrift, you're far more likely to fall into the, you know, where they want you to be, with drugs and pornography and alcohol and, you know, these bizarre sexual encounters that come in bars at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, things like this. This is sold to people as, you know, this is freedom.
Right. Hey, Joe, you mentioned the sexual encounters in bars. I don't know if you guys have seen the commercials. We have not belittled ourselves enough to actually give this television show a moment's attention more than just the soundbite on the commercial. But there's this new show, I think it's called Lucky Bastards, and it's about these rich playboys, and the whole show is seemingly geared towards their sexual escapades and how cool that they are, and don't you want to be like them kind of
sure.
a thing.
Well, I mean, once you've got Miley Cyrus, you're basically, and of course, just the round-the-clock pornography that young men experience through the computers. I mean, you just are about as broken down culturally in this area as is possible. You know, I look at, I talk to young guys, and I'm talking like 13, 14, and I know what they must be doing on their computers, because I know I've seen the national statistics that essentially like 40, 50% of the time spent on the internet is watching pornography. And I always wonder, you know, like, well, what would such an individual expect would happen on the first date? You know,
right.
I mean, what kind of training, where does this lead? And so there's just no way that, in my mind, you can get from there to the kind of relationship that would have some positive value in their life. And so you can see that the people who develop pornography, and it really amazingly can actually be traced to Bernays and the Damaged Goods, the play that he put on Broadway in 1913, you can see that this was, you know, it's deliberate. It takes us to a certain place. And there has just been so much damage, even though we don't know it, we don't see it, but we're really like people walking around after the atomic blast at Hiroshima. What we see, you know, through our minds, what is there in our culture, this is what was left after all of the destruction, after the blast and the violence that was done to us for the last 100 years. And so, you know, we are really in critical shape. And to make any progress toward a better future, you know, you need the energy and clearness of mind to recognize how you've been hit, how the damage has occurred. And so that's why, you know, we do what we do. And you guys are certainly to be commended. Jan, of course, you know, this is really what needs to happen. The alternative media, which is simply a machine to destroy culture and destroy us, has to have an alternative. And while as long as the internet's up, boy, we should be taking full advantage of it. And all of us should be, you know, in doubling up our efforts, because this is critical times and we need some help.
And very well said. That play that you mentioned, Joe, of Bernays, correct me if I'm wrong, but in your video, the audio from the interview with him talking about it, the whole point was to get people to buy membership to something else.
Well, sure, and not only that, but you know, they're promoting this idea of, you know, it was for venereal disease, and you know, the Rockefellers, they wanted to study venereal disease, and look at, you know, they were just philanthropic good guys, but the idea was really to promote a single mom and this guy and this whole sex scene to encourage people to go out and have sex to create more venereal disease. Now, let me also mention here real quick that year before last, I interviewed Curtis Duncan on my show, and the episode is about the conspiracy to feminize males and masculinize females. So what I'm going to do is I'll send you a link to my interview with Karen Strauhan of Girl Writes What, and I will also send you the link to my interview with Gary Wilson on my interview on porn. So maybe you can post those three episodes up with the notes for this episode.
Yes, we'll do that, definitely. You know, it's something else that you were bringing up about in this last part of the show. We were talking about relying upon your own senses and reason. And, you know, ironically, it made me think of the last words attributed to the Buddha, which I often mention. And those were doubt and find your own light. You know, it's like doubt the mainstream religious messages around you and look to your own senses and your own reason and find your own religion within. Find your own light.
Well said by the Buddha.
Yeah, I know. It's ironically, you know, it's been misused. Right. Eastern philosophy has been misused across the board. I know.
Well, I don't know if it was misused. I think that was what it was created for, you know.
Right. Sure. So, you know, I think we should probably wrap this up so I'll be able to have a podcast small enough to upload without making it a 2 or 3-parter. And I really wanted to thank you both for being here for this conversation and give you an opportunity to promote anything, to mention anything now that you'd like to direct the listeners' attention to, and especially anything new coming out of the Irvin Atwill camp.
I think Joe and I...
Can I say something real quick before we go on to that?
Sure.
Joe, you were talking about the play from Bernays, and it made me think of a quote that I'd read in Propaganda, and it said it was one, I don't remember what page it was, but the quote goes, it was one of the doctrines of the reality. psychology that a certain stimulus often repeated would create a habit, or that the mere reiteration of an idea would create a conviction. And that brought to mind like commercials. As we talked before about the proliferation of pornography and everything like that. And it brought to mind also dance. Because personally, I really enjoy dancing, and I find it a spiritual expression too. But it's also a very powerful sensual experience as well. And as I was reading Propaganda, I started thinking of the movie THX 1138 and the part in the movie where the black dancers were dancing, you know, very, very provocatively. And that was given to the people as a prop for sexual tension release without the need for physical contact. And it just made me, it reminded me of a few years ago, I'd seen a Beyonce video in which I swear she was doing the exact same dance as I'd seen on THX 1138. And it made me think that, man, sex really is such a strong mode of control that they're using against us.
Well, never mind George Lucas and all of those connections there.
Right.
Right, exactly.
Well, you know, and George Lucas was one of the cameramen at the famous Rolling Stones, Altamont Rolling Stones murder.
Just wanted to point something out about that. Just one second. What real amusing is that at Altamont, Vito Paluchis.
Paluchis.
Vito was given a platform so that he could dance.
Watch the whole hit, right
in front of the audience. He was up there dancing.
So get this. But there's more. So you have Mick Jagger. He's up on stage. He's wearing red. Okay, and he is surrounded by his Hell's Angels. Okay, and then they do a ritual murder of Meredith Hunter, and behind the camera is a man called George Lucas, who creates Luke Skywalker, who is also, you know, Lucifer is based on the planet Venus, so it's an association to Lucifer. So you've got Satan on stage in red with his Hell's Angels committing the murder. The Lucifer is filming it. Vito is over on the side dancing to it all, and Tim Leary is there too.
Wow. Yeah, it's a pretty sick lineup. Frankly, once you start, you know, decoding these things, they all end up very badly. I actually think past a certain point, it's not productive. You just need to know in general, have understanding of the government's use of propaganda, the areas that they're in, and then just take positive action and develop your own capacity to reason. That's really where the defense is. Look, the oligarchs will always be preying on us. That's what they do. So we will never be safe unless we have the power to resist them, and that's always going to be found in reason.
And let me just really, really quickly here, before we go back to what's coming up soon, but I just want to give a brief rundown of the psychedelic 60s and beyond. And this is something that I posted to Facebook the other day. I've been doing all this research on MKUltra, but this is basically how the whole 60s movement into the present went. And it starts off, number one, you've got to be a psychopath or sociopath. You have to worship Huxley and be willing to do his bidding. You have to have a wealthy family or military intelligence background, such as the Laurel Canyon people, or have a background in psychiatry or psychology. You have to go to Esalen or Millbrook. You have to study Marshall McLuhan, Edward Bernays, Walter Lippmann, etc. Then you start a cult and you have lots of worshipers like Leary, Charlie Manson, Jim Jones, Aldous Huxley, Arthur Kleps, Steve Jobs, Ram Dass, Gordon Wasson, L. Ron Hubbard, Al Hubbard or Captain Trips that we mentioned earlier, Bill Wilson that founded AA. By the way, all of these people were related through Esalen and through their works with MKUltra. Hoffman with the creation of LSD, Terrence McKenna, Daniel Pinchbeck, etc. And then what you do is you write a book bragging about all of this stuff or selling it, and then you also, with that book or post, you rewrite history, make it look as though you were a saint in all of this whole thing, and then pretend that you weren't a part of the intel community, and your books and works essentially regurgitate the watered down and misleading story that all of the other books have already told, and then you go on tour and you sell this stuff, and then you're remembered as a saint.
Yeah, that's a good synopsis. I'll just conclude by saying new book is out, Shakespeare's Secret Messiah. Even though Shakespeare is seen as this dull literature, and it is on the surface narrative, it actually is plugged in very specifically to much of what we've been talking about. And I go into the origins of the mind control that Christianity represents in the book quite a bit. So Shakespeare's Secret Messiah, it's at the caesarsmessiah.com website. It's, you know, everywhere else, Amazon, et cetera, et cetera. And A. Frater and Mater, thank you so much. Jan, good to hear your voice, brother. Talk to you soon.
Yeah. Oh, and just so you all know, Joe and I are supposed to be speaking at the Paranoia Conference in San Diego. I believe that's in August.
August 2nd and 3rd. Yeah, we look forward to meeting you both there in person. Joe, is there any way that the TMC research department might get a digital copy of that Shakespeare's Messiah?
Sure. Happy to send one. Sure.
Excellent. We'd love to have you back on to discuss it.
Okay, brother.
It was really nice talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Likewise. And he goes on Frater's show after he goes on my show.
And Jan, of course.
What if I sweet talk you a little bit, Joe? I have a very convincing voice.
There you go. It's true.
I'm willing to worship you whenever.
Yes. Come, feel free to join the church of me. Hey, and, I had one more quick question for you guys, and we don't have to spend a lot of time about this, but I just recently heard of this something called the Venus Project, and I was wondering if either one of you had heard anything about this.
Oh, yeah, well, the Venus Project, that's, what's his name? Now it just slipped my mind. The old guy, he was involved.
Right. I forgot his name, too.
Jacques Fresco. And, you know, he was involved in the Zeitgeist movies, but essentially that's selling a technocracy. And, you know, he's another one of these people that hates the family unit and all of this stuff. But, you know, he's definitely in the mix of a technocracy and a total social control type system. And in fact, Stefan Molyneux has debated Peter Joseph a number of times, and Peter Joseph has lost the debates badly.
Mm. That's really interesting, because at face value, it seems to be something that is kind of like an outlook on the future
They mix it with a lot of truth, especially the Zeitgeist Part 1 had a lot of good stuff in it. And then you can see the agenda unroll in 2 and 3.
Mm. Well, it's just these things are harmless. And obviously the goals, the purported goals are, you know, nice, but they're harmless to someone who actually can look at them skeptically. You have to always look at these things in terms of whether or not they're asking you to give them trust, and then they will use the trust for some other purpose later on. I hate to say it, but Dave McGowan made the quote on Jan's show, I believe, in an interview where he said that he didn't think anyone with a soapbox, with a platform, wasn't under essentially the oligarch's control. And that's pretty much my position as well. I think if
and mine
when and you mine get too.
To
and,
yeah
and
when you get to the point
all.
Where you're yeah we're being promoted, you really have to worry about these individuals, you know.
Yeah. You should, you know people who make it and are truly successful, they should be able to do it on their own, and they don't need to become famous in a week or two. You know, it's like you should be able to have a history and show your dedicated work over the years and how you got from point A to point B. It, you know, it shouldn't be like one of these guys who, you know, they show up today and a week or two from now they're famous and they're everywhere.
And then they're nowhere after that.
And then they're nowhere, right.
Excellent points. Well, always an honor and a pleasure to speak to both of you gentlemen. I hope you have an awesome weekend. Full moon Friday the 13th here today. So
okay, thank you guys. talk to you soon.
And well, yeah, Jan, I'll be in touch if I have any technical issues, okay?
All right. Thanks, guys, and good talking to you, Joe. Good talking to you, Frater and Mater.
Thank you, guys.
Likewise, guys. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.